Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine you're an astronaut floating through the vastness of space with just endless solitude and quiet on all sides. Peaceful beauty, no? Or maybe just a little bit intimidating. Now imagine, as this intrepid astronaut, you come across a black hole in your travels, and maybe you lose your mind and you decide to jump in. What would happen? Well, here with me to talk about her new book, Black Hole Survival Guide, is Dr. Jan Levin, professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University in New York. Always good to talk with you, Jan.
Oh, Iram, it's so good. I would say to be here, but we're just sort of in the ether, aren't we?
We are absolutely in the ether. Let's get right into this idea of the book. This isn't the first book you've written about black holes, and it's not the first time you've been on Science Friday to talk about them, as we're saying. What is it about black holes that keeps you coming back for more?
Yeah, it's funny. Black holes are extraordinary in that they're astrophysically real. So, you know, the first time Einstein was presented with the idea of a black hole, a friend writes him a letter from the Russian front during World War I, right after he publishes General Relativity, with this mathematical solution. But, you know, Einstein sensibly said nature will protect us from their formation. So they're astounding because nature thought of a way to make them, which is incredible, by killing off a bunch of heavy stars. But they are more than that. Black holes are almost fundamental gravitational objects. They're almost like fundamental particles. There's something foundational about them. There's something theoretically impressive about them, that they're this unbelievable terrain on which we think about things.
And you open your book with the phrase that you repeat a lot all throughout the book, and that is, black holes are nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is different from what a lot of people think. And you go over that. A black hole is dark and bare and empty, you say, and that's a big concept to start off with. I mean, we all think, and you, as I say, you mentioned this in the book, that we're mistaught about what a black hole is.
Yeah, I mean, I had well-versed friends in science who were like, well, it's a really dense object. And so one of the sort of misconceptions I wanted to shuck away was this idea that black holes were things at all. They're really not things. A black hole is an empty space-time. It may be formed by a very dense object, so like the collapse of a star. But once that star creates the black hole, it's gone. The star continues to fall. And, you know, Sir Roger Penrose won the Nobel Prize in October for work he did in the 60s proving this, that once the star creates a curved space-time so strong that not even light can escape, the star itself is forced to continue to fall, and it's gone.
So where does it go?
Well, you know, that remains a quandary. In the same paper where Penrose talked about the inevitability of the formation of the black hole, he talks about the singularity, which people get very hung up on, that the black hole might have a region in its center where the space-time is so strongly curved that it creates an infinite curvature and it's a singularity. But that's not really the important part. We don't know where it goes. You know, we know that the star continues to fall, but the most important part is the event horizon, this region it leaves behind. We're protected from what goes on the inside by this event horizon. So the mystery of what happens inside remains and is being debated. But to some extent, you know, it's not our business.
There's so much to talk about. And the event horizon is one of my favorite subjects mm-hmm. with a black hole to talk yeah. about, because I'm not quite sure what it looks like. For example, in the pictures we see of a black hole, the event horizon, and in movies where they try to make a black hole, the event horizon is a disk that comes out from the black hole. My question, is it a disk like a ring around Saturn? Or does that disk go around the whole black hole so that you see it on edge from wherever you are?
So this is very interesting, because really the event horizon is a spherical point in space. It's a place, not a thing. And it's a shadow. It's literally like asking about the shadow of a tree. And so when you're describing the rings of Saturn, like we saw in the movie Interstellar,
right,
or
exactly.
what we saw with the Event Horizon Telescope, what you're looking at is the luminous material around the black hole that's casting the shadow. Imagine the shadow of a tree you don't have a shadow of a tree unless you have a source of light. And so you have to illuminate the tree to cast the shadow. And so this disc that you're describing is casting the shadow. It's illuminating the area around it. And because the space-time is so strongly curved that even the light from this disc, like the rings of Saturn, give you the illusion that they're above and below the black hole. It is just a total illusion. That casts the shadow of the event horizon. The event horizon itself, like if you were to fall across an event horizon, it would be as unspectacular as stepping into the shadow of a tree.
Well, let's talk about that. So that shadow does go around the whole black, entire black hole. It follows your eye around the entire black hole. Now, let's talk about your astronaut falling into the event horizon. Take us through what happens.
Well, so, you know, black holes are so perilous from many angles, and falling inside seems to capture people's imagination. It's very interesting that if you fell inside a black hole about the mass of the sun, the thing about black holes is they're small for their heft, right? So you take something as heavy as the sun, and it's only 6 kilometers across that shadow. So you cross within that 6 kilometer shadow, and you're on the inside. You have a very short fraction of a second to live before you're terrorized by the extreme curvature in the center. So the event horizon itself is actually not that bad. You can just float right across. If it was dark against a dark background, you wouldn't even know you were encountering a black hole. You could just kind of float happily, drift to the inside, where you would be shredded and pulverized and all the things that people describe, because the space-time is so strongly curved that your feet are pulled away from your head and your body and your ligaments are torn apart and until you're into your...
I hate it when that happens.
And then your fundamental bits go the fate of the star that originally formed the black hole, which is to say we don't know exactly what that fate is.
All right, let's go to a great question from a listener, Mary Lee in Pittsburgh, on our Science Friday Vox Pop app.
So when people describe black holes, they describe them as eating things or consuming things, but a black hole doesn't chew anything or absorb its nutrients. So I'm just wondering what actually happens when it consumes something.
So I think the most dramatic example of this is when two black holes merge. And what you see when that happens is that the event horizon deforms around the object it's absorbing. In this case, the two black holes, it's so strong, the two event horizons just totally bubble and deform. And they create these sort of audible, I mean, very faint to our ears, that's why we require a detector, but these audible ringing in space-time until it settles down to being a quiet black hole. So the really impressive thing about black holes, to your listener's question, is that once it absorbs something, it deforms a little bit for a second, but then it becomes flawless and featureless again. It sheds those imperfections and it grows a little bit and then it quiets down and settles down. That is unlike anything in the universe. Any other object in the universe, you can put a little mountain, a little flaw, a little deformity. You can change it, alter it, but not a black hole. A black hole is flawless.
And you say in the book they are all identical.
Yeah, it's really stunning. If you think of something like a fundamental particle, like an electron, there's no electron that's a little bit heavier than any other electron. They're exactly the same. They're so much the same that we consider them to be technically identical. They're interchangeable. There's no history to them. And once a black hole settles down after you've thrown something in, it is absolutely flawless and featureless and identical to every other black hole of that weight.
And you say it's perfect.
Yeah, they are literally flawless. Ugh. You cannot have a mountain or a blemish on a black hole for long. It will shed it away.
Yeah, the process I think that was described, and I've read in other places that it sheds its hair. Is that the hair that's settling down and then it becomes smooth and bald, I guess?
I mean, none of this was obvious. You know, you think that when Schwarzschild first wrote that letter to Einstein in 1916, he wrote down this beautiful mathematical solution, but it was decades of people laboring over it to understand these things. The no hair theorems, which you're referring to, exactly suggest that a black hole has to be featureless. I mean, to put it in most simplistic terms, because it forbids the transmission of any information inside the event horizon, it has to be featureless. I mean, after all, if it had features, I could determine what was on the inside, but the event horizon tells me I can't. So yeah, in a sense, they really are perfect, flawless objects. And I mean, I want to say not objects, but places.
Places, that's better, because now we know there's nothing inside a black hole. A good question from Dave on Twitter. What would happen if two black holes met? Would the one with a weaker gravitational pull get sucked into the other? Would weird singularity stuff get sucked out of the weaker one?
Well,
people are thinking about
this. Yeah, it's really interesting. When LIGO was so widely reported, when they recorded the sound of the space-time ringing from the collision of two black holes, they didn't really talk about this very much. But this is exactly what happened. A smaller black hole merged with a bigger black hole, particularly in the first event, which was detected, which the merger happened over a billion years ago. So yeah, what's really happening is you have two nothings, which are just deformations in space-time, warping each other's
space. You say that so nonchalantly. Two nothings that are just deformations in space-time.
Like two shapes, basically.
Okay, there you go.
Two shapes in space-time. And when they get close to each other, though, you notice that the shapes become unlike either one alone. And eventually what happens is they merge into a bigger black hole. But as with what happened with the gravitational wave experiment, which recorded the sound of the space-time ringing, is that a significant amount of the energy comes out in the ringing of the space-time, which is shedding away all of those imperfections that we're talking about. So that what results, even when two black holes of equal size merge, is a perfect, flawless black hole. And all of the imperfections ring out in the space-time and can be recorded by instruments like LIGO. So we have the event of the merger of two black holes that was first seen in 2015, I guess, first detected, was the most energetic event we've detected since the Big Bang.
That's pretty big.
And none of it came out as light. None of it. Like, that's wild. It all came out in the ringing of space-time. And that's just crazy.
Speaking of perfect and flawless, I'm talking with Dr. Jana Levin, physics and astronomy professor at Barnard College at Columbia University in New York. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Hey there, folks. It goes without saying this has been a challenging year, no? And if there's one thing we know for sure, it's that the need for fact-based journalism and the need for science are stronger than ever. At a time when science is continually called into question, Science Friday remains committed to filtering out the noise and discussing the evidence supporting the science that you need to make informed decisions. You know that demand for Science Friday this year was higher than ever, but you may not know that your donations are what's keeping us running. And right now, Science Friday has a dollar-for-dollar donation match, which means that any donations will be doubled. So, if you have a few dollars to spare and agree that this world could use more science, please support Science Friday with a donation. Any amount makes a difference. Go to sciencefriday.com/give. That's sciencefriday.com/give. Thank you, and stay safe. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Jana Levin, author of Black Hole Survival Guide. This is a great little black book, right? With a black hole on it. It's a cute little book.
It's
everything
cute.
Everything you ever wanted to know about black holes, I think, is in this book. You know, I remember years ago when I first started out in this business, I interviewed John Archibald Wheeler. Supposedly, he was the originator of the term black hole.
Yeah, so the story I've heard, apparently he was giving a lecture down Broadway and got exhausted. This is 1967. Got exhausted saying the inevitable consequence of gravitational collapse, or I don't know, he had to keep saying these really elaborate terms, and supposedly someone from the back row shouted, "How about black hole?" and Wheeler, in his unbelievably witty way, just foisted the term on the physics community. He wrote shortly thereafter that, like the Cheshire Cat, fades from view, leaving only its smile. I'm butchering the quote, you know, the black hole fades from view, leaving only its gravitational attraction. And in that phrase, he foists black hole on us.
That's terrific. That's a great story. You know, Jana Levitt, author of Black Hole Survival Guide, you remind me, I'm always looking for great physicists who can speak, you know, to the public like you do. You're a great communicator. And your book reminds me of one of my all-time favorite books about physics, Quantum Physics for Poets, written by the late, great Leon Lederman with Christopher T. Hill as co-author. Do you feel like you're an evangelist for black holes?
You know, it's really, I write about what I love. Maybe I should think more about the audience, but I don't. My first port of call is the subject that I love.
But you got interested in black holes very early in life, right? You write in your book how interested you were as a child.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things was that it just was normal to me to read about black holes. These were just normal. You know, they had already been discovered. They had already been observed out in nature. And so to kind of reverse the process of rediscovering how remarkable they were and how remarkable their discovery was kind of moving, because I took it for granted. Of course, there's other galaxies out there. I mean, when Einstein was writing his first papers, we did not know there were other galaxies out there. And we take all of this for granted. So I think there was this kind of reverse reinvention of it for me, rediscovering them.
How much of the mathematics describing black holes, describing the singularity, understanding what's inside that spot, how much of it is real? And how much of it is just mathematical?
You know, this is profound, because even the fact that that's a question means that there's a crisis that we have to solve. What does it mean to say it's real or not real? Like, the star falls, it creates the black hole. What happens to it? We're back to the opening question. It's not to be dismissed. It's a major crisis in trying to understand what happens to what falls inside of a black hole. For a long time, I think there was this hope that, well, we're protected by the event horizon. We don't ever have to really know. It's not our business. You know, it like happens inside the black hole. But we're beginning to realize that forcing ourselves to try to address that question might hold the clues to the theory of everything. Like, really the theory that unifies matter and gravity together.
Because that's the big mystery, right? We haven't found the gravitons or the quantum equivalents of gravity, right?
That's right. We don't know how to quantize gravity.
That happens in a black hole?
Well, the black hole seems to be the terrain on which we have to figure it out. It's really the only frontier that we know of, which is both real in astrophysics and on paper in math, that is giving us the clues to try to understand what that quantum theory of gravity is. And it's so elusive that, you know, it goes to Hawking's observation that black holes evaporate through some very subtle quantum process, which is forcing us to try to ask, well, if it evaporates, we need to understand what happened to the stuff that fell inside. We're no longer protected. We're no longer forever safely on the other side of that one-way window. Because if they evaporate, eventually the event horizon is yanked up and we're forced to look inside and confront what happened to that star or that astronaut that fell in.
Do we need new concepts in physics? Do we need new physics
wow,
to explain
yeah.
this?
Yeah, and I think there was some question over whether or not I should go into the quantum aspects of the black hole in this book, because it really is the hard stuff.
We like the hard stuff on this show, so you can get into the grass a little bit more, in the weeds.
See, I love that. I love that stuff, because when I was a kid, I thought scientists memorized equations and spat out facts. And that's obviously terribly false and a terrible stereotype. And what I've realized is the most exciting part of science is when you don't know the answer. And that's where we are right now. We're on the cusp. Like, it's almost within reach, but we don't quite understand it. So yes, the most interesting concepts coming out of theoretical physics right now are on the theoretical terrain of the black hole. So if something falls inside, is it connected by a quantum wormhole to the Hawking radiation on the outside. I mean, the ideas are wild, wild right now.
You could go to another universe on the other side of a black hole. Could be another universe.
The best way to survive a black hole is to hope that your quantum bits find life elsewhere. Yes.
So at least we know what we don't know, right? We've narrowed down what we don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. Black holes, in terms of just their space-time description, are very knowable. We understand them beautifully. There aren't paradoxes or mysteries. It's the quantum aspects where we run into paradoxes and mysteries.
All right, getting into the weeds a little bit more here. We have a question from R. Day on Twitter, who says something you mentioned a bit ago. Explain how black holes evaporate. Do they really disappear?
Wow. I mean, this is what earned Hawking his fame. And, you know, here was this sort of inimical character who is provoking people, literally sort of grinning while he caused people great duress. It's very subtle process. The black hole doesn't emit anything. It steals energy from the vacuum around it. So a black hole is nothing, as we've described. There's this event horizon, which is just an empty region of space where you'd have to travel faster than the speed of light to escape the black hole. There's nothing there, but the black hole manages to steal from the quantum vacuum. And this, if you want to get into the weeds, goes back to Schrodinger's very profound observation that there is an uncertainty in where a particle is or what it's doing. But that also means that you can't say a particle's not there. There's no such thing as nothing. You can no longer have absolute nothing, because that would mean you had this infinite precision in knowing a particle was not there.
Right. Okay. We're following.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, go ahead.
So because of that, there's this sort of frothing possibility that the nothingness of space-time has a frothing possibility of particles kind of being there sort of virtually. The black hole has this ability that Hawking pointed out to steal from the vacuum, steal from this potential. So imagine there's a nothingness. There are two particles that are kind of, you can't firmly say they're there or not there. They cancel each other's qualities, so they're perfectly matched, so that they match the nothingness of space-time. You can't have them both be electrically charged, for instance. They have to be opposites to cancel everything. The black hole has the ability to steal one of this virtual pair that's bubbling out of the nothingness of the quantum vacuum and leaving exposed its partner. And its partner can't go back to being nothing without its pair. And so the partner just escapes. And that's what the Hawking radiation is. It's an incredibly subtle process. But none of it originates from inside the black hole.
So if you have enough of those events, then your black hole is leaking and evaporating.
That's right. The black hole steals energy from the vacuum. It actually gets lighter in the process. It loses mass in the process. And this light escapes out into space-time. And in principle, we've never seen this because bigger black holes are cool. They don't evaporate very quickly. We haven't observed this yet, but tiny black holes would explode.
Wow.
It actually is inverse to what you might think. And so what happens is the black hole technically over a very, very long time scale will get smaller and the event horizon will shrink. And yet none of it originated from inside the black hole. So here's the crisis. What happened to the stuff that fell inside the black hole? If it didn't come out in the radiation, which would be logical, that would be fine, like it came out in the radiation, but you're suddenly no longer protected from the horrors of the interior of the black hole if it evaporates.
And yet we don't know what happened to it, is what you're saying.
But what's beautiful about it is that it's provoking the most profound conversations about quantum gravity.
Well, we're having one right here now.
Yeah. So it's giving us the sort of fundamental clues. It's prodding us in the right direction, if you know what I mean. It's giving us the signs along the way.
That's great. You know, there are so many questions, so little time. Let me ask about our own black hole that we have at the center of our Milky Way, correct? Is that a prerequisite for a galaxy now to have a black hole in its center?
Well, I mean, nobody expected this. So even after black holes had been named, which took 50 some years, even after they had been observed, nobody expected black holes millions of times or billions of times the mass of the sun. That was totally unanticipated. We call those supermassive black holes. We knew that stars collapsing could form black holes tens of times the mass of the sun, or even maybe even hundreds, but millions or billions of times the mass of the sun, that was unpredicted. And to answer your question, yeah, we think that basically every sort of normal galaxy has a supermassive black hole at its center. And that is hundreds of billions of galaxies in our observable universe. So there are hundreds of billions of supermassive black holes that we don't know where they came from, how they formed. But we do think that they had maybe a really important role in terms of sculpting the galaxies in which they live, forming regions which are hospitable for life. So they might be very influential in terms of our emergence.
I don't have a whole lot of time left because I love to talk about this. I'll try to get this question in. It's one of my favorite topics. Spooky action at a distance. What Einstein made that up. What is it and how could it play into black holes?
Oh, I wish I could say it in German. Sometimes it's translated as ghostly. It may play a role in our quantum understanding of black holes. There are these very creative, wonderful physicists like Lenny Susskind who think about Einstein's thought experiment way back when, which was when he said that phrase, spooky action at a distance. So what Einstein was talking about, he was talking about these pairs of particles that form, which are so opposite that they cancel each other, essentially. I liken it to like a yellow droplet of paint and a blue droplet of paint combining to make green. If they came from green, they better be yellow and blue in order to make the green. And so these pairs we call entangled pairs. They have to cancel each other's properties, and yet there's this sense in which, you know, they don't necessarily, in that Schrodinger uncertainty principle way, don't necessarily manifest in some concrete way. And so right now, one of the biggest ideas about black holes is exactly about that. The idea that there are these wormholes, possibly, which are connecting a particle. So if a black hole stole a particle from the vacuum and released a particle that came out as Hawking radiation, maybe they're connected through a wormhole. I know
Whoa, it sounds crazy. My hair is hurting.
But the idea is maybe the particle on the inside and the particle on the outside are connected by an entangled wormhole in the spirit that Einstein, that he was thinking about back then. And so the stuff that fell in the black hole is getting out because it's the same. It's entangled or connected by a wormhole with the stuff that came out.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. In case you're joining us now, we're talking with Dr. Jana Levin, author of this terrific new book, Black Hole Survival Guide, everything you've ever wanted to know about black holes. But how do you prove that? Can you make any experiments? Or, you know, science really needs evidence, right?
Well, I appreciate the question. I also believe math is evidence.
Oh.
And if it makes predictions mathematically that are confirmed, then I think that's encouraging. If not, you know, a smoking gun, it's encouraging. And so a lot of these predictions are able mathematically to make predictions that correspond to sort of other calculations, like they all fit together. It's like assembling a puzzle on your table and all the pieces fit together. It's not exactly an observation, but on your table, they all fit together, which is encouraging.
One last thing on our table. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about astrophysics. Astrophysics didn't win a Nobel Prize until the 1970s. And now this year, the prize was awarded to three scientists for black hole specific research. Are we seeing a renaissance in black hole research? Should we expect some sort of breakthrough in any of these questions that you're talking about?
I think it's really interesting. So back when Hubble was observing galaxies for the first time in the 20s, the first galaxies that we realized were outside of the Milky Way, he really lobbied hard for astrophysics to be considered for the Nobel Prize. And he did not succeed. Hubble did not get a Nobel Prize. Astrophysics, like you said, was not considered for the Nobel Prize until the 70s. And this century, we've had at least two Nobel Prizes for black holes alone, just black holes. I would say that previous to the start of the century, black holes were fading in terms of their centrality for physics. And suddenly they're back again. And they're back not just astrophysically, but also theoretically. So I feel like we're kind of living in the century for black holes.
That's great. I wish we could talk more. This book is excellent, as all of Jan Levin's books are. Black Hole Survival Guide. You need this when you're going out into space. Take it with you. You can read it as your time is changing. We didn't even get into the time.
Yeah.
The aspect. That's incredibly crazy stuff. Janet, thank you for taking time to be with us. It's a great book.
Thanks so much, Ari. So fun to talk to you.
Dr. Janet Levin, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University in New York, author of the new book, Black Hole Survival Guide. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're coming back down to Earth, talking with a scientist who takes the pulse of scallops and a composer who makes music from the sounds of rivers. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you jump in your car in Manhattan and drive about, 85 miles east out to Long Island, you'll reach a spot where the island forks into two spits of land, the remains of ancient glaciers as they retreated thousands of years ago. In between the north and southern forks is the Peconic Bay, which opens out to the Atlantic Ocean. The bay, like much of the waters around Long Island, has been losing its shellfish at an alarming rate. First, there was the loss of 90% of the lobsters in Long Island Sound, and now we have a die-off in scallops. This is bad news for a community where harvesting shellfish has long been an important part of the local economy. Here to discuss the science, the biology behind this, is Stephen Tomasetti, PhD candidate in marine science at Stony Brook University in Southampton, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
When did people notice that the scallop populations were dwindling?
Well, these die-offs have now happened 2 years in a row before the start of the scallop fishing season, which begins in November. The first reports were sometime around early August of 2019. And local baymen were reporting either cluckers, which are really just dead scallops, they're open shells with no muscle tissue, or seeing no scallops at all. And this die-off was then confirmed in October of 2019 through a number of dive surveys that were done by Dr. Steve Tettelbeck and a group of researchers from both Stony Brook and Cornell.
And how much of a die-off is it?
Well, both years, it's been quite dramatic. We're talking something around 95% decrease in 2019, and now we're about 99% decrease in 2020.
And are these baby scallops that just don't thrive, or are they adult ones that just die?
Great question. Bay scallops have very unique life histories. They usually live for up to 2 years, and they spawn or reproduce just a few times in their lifetime. So typically at times in the summer, they release their eggs and sperm in the water. That's where fertilization happens. And then the larvae sort of drift around for a while before they become juveniles and attach to seagrass blades where they grow. We call these baby scallops bugs, and we're finding bugs each year in our surveys. So biologically, the scallops are doing what they're supposed to do. The adults are surviving long enough to spawn. But then sometime in that window between the spawning events and the start of the fishing season, the mortality is happening among the adults.
And is this a problem just in the New York waterways, or are populations going down everywhere?
Good question. We know that bay scallops historically have been on the decline, if we look at compared to the 70s to today. But in terms of this sort of drastic decline, we've seen that happen before in New York in the past, in the 80s, due to harmful algal blooms. But currently, these Pecanic estuary scallops are all I know of that are declining so rapidly. I know the Cape Cod populations, by all accounts, seem to have a normal year last year, whereas we did not.
Okay, so let's talk about what you might think is causing this. Any guesses? Could it be climate change? Could it be what?
Well, we're putting together the pieces in this puzzle now. I should say that this has been a very collaborative effort. After that first die-off, our local Pecanic Estuary Program, which is affiliated with the EPA, put together a technical advisory committee. And now after going through a second year of a summer die-off, we know a lot more. And it seems to boil down to a few different things. And the two things are energetics and potentially also predation. So when marine biologists study environmental stress, we think a lot about bioenergetics. We try to learn about what's called an organism's aerobic scope, which really just means the amount of extra energy that's available for spawning, for growth, for immune defense. And when environmental conditions become stressful, like say, for instance, due to high temperature or low dissolved oxygen levels, then that surplus energy shrinks. And if there becomes a point when the animal needs more energy than it has reserved, it can lead to mortality. So we already know from different lab studies that bay scallops are particularly sensitive in terms of mollusks in our bay. And we also know that in 2019, we had anomalously high temperatures for the summer. On top of that, Stony Brook's Marine Animal Disease Lab is also looking at a parasite that could have added additional stress. So there's a lot going on. But the other side is that it also could be predators. Cow-nosed rays have been spotted last year in multiple Long Island bays. And these are warm water predators that are now being found in our local waters in the summers. So to answer your question about climate change, I think it is very likely. There's a great study that shows the warming climate in our region has led to not only higher average water temperatures throughout the year, but also a higher frequency of extremely hot summer days, which we know can be very stressful. So you combine that with these other localized issues, and now the scallops are dealing with multiple difficult stressors at the same time. But even if it's not environmental stress and it's predators, like I said before, those cow-nosed rays are warm water predators and their summer migrations are reaching further and further north. And you know they may be coming in more and more numbers. So either way you look at it, it seems climate change is probably playing an important role here.
Interesting, because climate change also has a factor where the water, because there's so much CO2 in the air, the CO2 is being dissolved in the water and acidifying the water, which marine creatures don't like either. Could that also be a factor?
Yeah, that's a great point. That's mainly what I work on, to be honest, is hypoxia and acidifications. And particularly calcifying organisms are susceptible to these types of stress. You see it more often in baby scallops and larvae where they're trying to develop that shell because it becomes very difficult to develop that early shell when you have acidified waters. But since these are adults that are typically dying, even though acidification might be playing a role in the issue, it's likely not the main or only driver of mortality.
You know, lobsters used to thrive in Long Island Sound, and 90% of those lobsters are now gone, and the word is that they have migrated north toward New England. Could this happen to the scallops also?
Well, there are scallops up and down the East Coast, going down to Florida, all the way up to the New England area, and there's different subspecies of scallops. So some of them are more adapted to certain temperature regimes, and we might see, you know, either a restriction in the scallop range if temperature is playing a very important factor here, or you could see an expansion northward, like what you just mentioned with the lobsters.
And of course, this must be a tremendous disappointment and social impact, the economic impact to the Long Island economy, to the fishermen.
Oh, yes. The region here, you know, provides lots of both jobs and revenue to local fishermen. So these are economically important species, but they're also an environmentally important species. Scallops are bivalves. And they have two shells, like oysters and clams, and along with other bivalves, they play an important role in the environment because they filter feed. So they remove microscopic algae from the water column, which is important because in many places, if this algae isn't efficiently removed, then it eventually dies and it gets broken down by microbes in the water. That process will deplete the dissolved oxygen in the water, and leads to sort of poor water quality.
They're sort of like the ocean's vacuum cleaners.
Exactly. So these animals help to protect this environment they live in.
It's my understanding that you're studying the scallops with a scallop Fitbit. You got to tell me about this. What does it look like and what information can you get out of a scallop Fitbit?
Yes. Basically, scallop Fitbits look like a bunch of jumbled wires, but they're actually reflective optical infrared sensors. And we use them to measure scallop heartbeat rates. And they're waterproofed and then glued to the surface of the scallop shell just above where the heart is. And then I connect them to a microcontroller board, which is like a small computer, and that logs data onto an SD card, and it all goes in the bay together. So all of this equipment with the scallops. And the way it works is the sensor both shines, but also detects infrared light. And so every time that scallop heart contracts, the amount of reflected infrared light that's detected by the sensor changes. So when I measure that over a period of time, I can see these regular oscillations in the amount of reflected light. And then I can use that to quantify the scallop heartbeat rates.
And what does a scallop heartbeat sound like?
Well, they typically beat at somewhere between 15 to about 30 beats per minute when they're, you know, sort of in resting conditions. But then what's cool about this method is that we learn how the scallop is responding to changes in its environment. So, you know, we're also simultaneously measuring the water. And if we might see a scallop heartbeat rate even like triple under low oxygen conditions, that they might be in for, let's say, 10 hours. And so that heartbeat rate can then be used as a measure of how quickly they're using up their energy reserves.
Interesting. Can you apply your little Fitbit to other sick marine creatures?
Yes. In fact, people have used this same technology to look at crabs as well. So fiddler crabs and also blue crabs. And people have used it for other bivalves as well.
One last question for you, and it's sort of my blank check question. If I had a blank check, I would give it to you. But of course, we're not in the same room. If you could get the answer to anything, what would you like to know? And the blank check means you can spend your money on any kind of material, resources, or whatever. What's the thing you want to know most?
That's great. Well, I'll give you a modest answer because, to be honest, the main question I'd like to answer is the question that's driving this chapter of my dissertation research. So as I mentioned before, I'm very interested in both the threshold temperatures, so high temperatures and low dissolved oxygen levels, at which these scallops are adversely affected. So for me, the big picture is really about how does the timing of these spawning events, which we know are a very energy intensive process, impact their vulnerabilities to stress from high temperatures and low oxygen. So is it that this spawning events occurring at a certain time in the summer is really exhausting their energy reserves? I'd like to get an answer to that question.
Well, we hope you do, and we wish you good luck on your dissertation.
Thank you very much.
You know, send them a little copy of this interview on Science Friday. Maybe that will help you with the committee.
Oh, I hope so.
Stephen Tomasetti, PhD candidate in marine science at Stony Brook University in Southampton, New York. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. One of the major rivers that feeds Long Island Sound is the Housatonic. It meets the Sound in the town of Milford, Connecticut, and begins about 150 miles north in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. Like many rivers in the Northeast, it has a long history of pollution from factories that were built along its banks. For decades, General Electric's plant in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, dumped toxic PCBs into the river. Parts of the Housatonic were declared a Superfund site. And even after more than 20 years of cleanup, the river is still contaminated. But for long, wild stretches, the river snakes through mountains and under covered bridges. And you wouldn't know about its troubles. It starts here, with a mountain spring trickling out of a metal pipe.
My name is Anaya Lockwood. I'm a composer. I make pieces for singers and instrumentalists, but also I do a lot of environmental sound recording, and I have done for many years, going back to the 60s.
This year marks the 10th anniversary of Lockwood's detailed sound map of the Housatonic River. She had previously completed sound maps of the Hudson and the Danube. Lockwood, who's now 81, does her recordings from the banks of the rivers using stereo microphones and hydrophones to listen underwater. All of her sound maps are meant to be listened to as immersive sound installations, where listeners travel with her as the rivers change and grow. So if you can, you might want to put on your headphones.
I'm doing it almost entirely by ear. In other words, I look at local maps, look at areas that are marshy, for example, where I expect to be able to find a lot of aquatic bugs and maybe good underwater sources. Look at areas where the flow is clearly going to be fast, in which case I get very complex water textures, which I love, and then just let my ears guide me. I want to draw people into the energy of the river, and by that means arouse associations, personal associations in people's minds with rivers that they know and love, and from there move on to trigger concern about the health of rivers. That's my aim. But the sound has to be right, has to be really good for that immersion, you know, of a listener. I don't want the sounds of oars or paddles to be included in the recording. I sort of don't want people's attention to be drawn away from the actual energy of the river itself. So I always just record from the bank. Besides, the banks are so interesting. I mean, that's where the friction is between water and land, and the sounds which rivers create at their banks are beautiful and complex and varied, tremendously varied. I remember being truly shocked when I got to Pittsfield, and I remember reading a sign which pointed out PCB contamination in the mud, and if you were trying to embark on a canoe or a kayak, make sure to wash your legs as quickly as you possibly could. And it was the first time I'd seen that sort of warning. It was shocking. And when I got to do a recording which was purely of an underwater environment, I'd been recording underwater in various spots by then, on the Danube and up in Montana and in New York, and was used to hearing a lot of activity underwater. Should have been plenty going on, late spring, early summer, but there was very, very little, and I wondered if PCB contamination and the other contamination which had been flowing downriver for so long had just sort of decimated underwater populations, not just of fish, but of smaller creatures too. No river, in my experience, has an overall characteristic, you know, by which you could identify, that's the Danube, or that's the Hudson, or that's the Housatonic. Every single site on a river has its own characteristic. So I regard rivers as live phenomena which actively create their sound by the way they work with the materials of their banks and restructure their banks and change their banks, and not to mention the bed of the river changing constantly. So every single site has its own sound. And moreover, every site's sound changes somewhat within a very short space of time. There's no pinning a river down. And I like that very much.
You can explore more of Anaya Lockwood's sound map of the Housatonic River on our website. Our story was produced by Science Friday's John Dankosky. If you missed any part of this program, or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Have a great holiday week. I'm Ira Flatow.